Welcome to the No More, Risk Better, a Credit Sites podcast. I'm Winnie Caesar, the Global Head of Strategy.
And I'm Zach Griffiths, the Credit Sites Senior Investment Grade Strategist.
As strategists, we aim to make sense of the macro and the micro, highlighting opportunities and the risks facing the fixed income markets.
As important as the macro call may be, we understand that credit investing, at its core, comes down to keen single name selection, and we at Credit Sites benefit from the expertise of our team of over 100 analysts across the US, Europe, and Asia.
This podcast offers a look at the conversations that we have with our analysts on a regular basis. If you are an investment professional focused on the wide universe of fixed income, you'll want to give this podcast a listen. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Credit Sites podcast. This is Winnie Caesar, Global Head of Strategy at Credit Sites. And today we are talking all things Euro, consumer, and autos with two of our esteemed senior analysts. We have Miriam Ali, our Euro consumer goods senior analyst, and Jim Williamson, our European autos senior analyst. I am so excited to have this conversation today because clients are constantly asking me, what is happening with the state of the consumer. So thank you for joining. We're going to jump right in with a speed round. And the first thing I want to ask, and I'll start with you, Miriam, is how would you characterize 4Q23 earnings season in general? Was it good? Was it bad? Was it ugly? Something else?
Thanks for that, Winnie. On the consumer side, both IG and high yield, I would say that generally things have been in line with expectations. Maybe a couple of companies surprised slightly more to the up or downside. But 4Q earnings generally showed a continuation of trends that we saw earlier in the year. Categories and geographies that were struggling before continue to do so, and the strongest categories continue to do well. And I can elaborate on those later.
Great. And how about you, Jim?
Yeah, I think overall, I'd say earnings were pretty solid in autos as well, once again. I think importantly, the outlooks were also pretty robust. I think, you know, for the best part of 2 to 3 years now, people have kind of been waiting for this inevitable pullback in consumer demand due to the higher rates, especially in autos. But aside for, you know, some rumblings in the background around EV demand, which I think we're going to get to a little bit later on, I think what's been interesting in the autos is that while we've seen quite a large number of challenges since the pandemic, they've all kind of come one by one rather than all at once. So you had, you know, 2021, we had the volume shortages and supply chain constraints, but that was offset by the very strong demand. 2022 by the raw material prices, but again was offset by strong pricing. And even now with this kind of more balanced supply demand picture we're getting, putting some pressure on pricing, but we're seeing those cost pressures starting to ease. So overall, I'd say it's kind of lent itself to, you know, a period of really strong operating performance, but also not a lot of volatility in terms of operating performance. And so obviously that's, you know, one of the Goldilocks environments for investors in terms of, you know, visibility going forward. And so I think that's a dynamic that will continue.
That is super interesting. Goldilocks has definitely come up quite frequently as, you know, is this the new normal, this Goldilocks environment? And that leads me to my next speed round question. So, Miriam, what has surprised you the most to start 2024?
Yeah, I think the biggest surprise for me has actually come outside earnings. And I think the big surprise for me really has been just how strong the rally has been for certain high yield consumer names. I think some of the gains we've seen this year have been truly extraordinary. We're talking bonds up more than 10 points for names that where there were legitimate questions just a few months ago about whether a refinancing would be possible. And now I guess the answer is a resounding yes. So I found the recovery of some of these bonds quite remarkable when actually you consider nothing's really changed on the fundamental side.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I think something that is true of a lot of different parts of the market. You know, I know we talk in the US a lot just about treasury yields. You know, they were 5% on the 10-year in October, and now they've, you know, moved a little bit higher from recent lows, but a lot of the concerns have seemingly evaporated from investor mind. So Jim, how about you in the auto sector? What is the biggest surprise to start the year?
Yeah, I mean, mine's kind of along a similar lines, I guess. For me, it's kind of how quickly sentiment shifted, you know, in terms of that kind of doom and gloom narrative that was very prevalent last year around recession risk. And that seems to be, you know, starting to flip. Our house view, correct, you know, you can maybe speak to this more than I can, Winnie, but our house view have been pretty constructive over the last year or so. You know, the fears over the impact of that higher for longer, you know, stagflationary backdrop seem to have eased a little bit, particularly if we kind of look on your side of the Atlantic in the US. I think some of the, you know, resilience of growth and unemployment trends have caught a lot of people by surprise so far. And I think that obviously has implications for the consumer side, but especially for autos, given, you know, financing plays a huge role in financing vehicle purchases. And while, you know, on the one hand, you know, undoubtedly higher financing rates do have a flow through effect, you know, especially given where we are relative to 2021 levels, it hasn't really had the impact that many people thought. So I think, you know, focusing on this narrative and coming to the conclusion of, you know, higher rates mean no one's going to be able to afford a car is largely being proven incorrect. You know, I think on the one hand, it does potentially push the marginal buyer to the sidelines, and that's, you know, may stifle some of the incremental growth in terms of like increasing vehicle sales. But on the whole, I think it's been pretty clear that, you know, as long as people have jobs, they feel pretty comfortable with the outlook of keeping those jobs, you know, they've so far been pretty content to allocate more of that disposable income to things like car payments. And so we've seen a lot of that absorbed. And I think the other thing that's kind of important to remember from a consumer perspective is that, you know, this environment hasn't all been bad for consumers. You know, like they've been hit by higher rates, sure, on the one hand, but labor markets have stayed pretty tight. It's been pretty good for things like wage growth. And so when you add that to, you know, some wealth effects out there with strong equity markets and things like that, ultimately, I think the consumer is probably feeling a little bit better than most people would have thought, given where rates are.
Yeah, absolutely. It does seem like the view is consumer a little bit better than what people would have expected. And that leads me to my final speed round question. If we've had this better than anticipated outcome for the consumer, what are some of your favorite economic data indicators that you're watching to make sure that that trend continues versus the consumer really starting to roll over? Mariam, what are you watching this year?
Yeah, so given my focus on the consumer sector, I'm going to give the obvious indicator, which is, of course, consumer confidence. So what we're seeing across Europe is actually maybe some slight improvement. It's still at depressed levels versus historical when you compare it to what we've seen historically. So I'd say consumers overall are still feeling pretty cautious, but at least not expecting a major drop off this year in terms of the macro environment. In the UK, consumer confidence in February actually did tick down a little bit. But reassuringly, within that, consumers are not seeing a deterioration of their personal financial situation over the next 12 months. And it's clearly going to be an interesting year for UK consumers, given the upcoming election. So overall, I would say that consumer confidence is kind of ticking along, gradually improving, but I don't think we're yet really seeing a major positive turn in sentiment just yet.
Yeah, I would agree with that kind of general sentiment, with not necessarily seeing a positive turn, but, you know, perhaps kind of a troughing. Consumer sentiment definitely took it on the chin for a couple of years, and now it's just kind of a steady state, but, you know, lower than perhaps some of the central banks would like it to be. And so, Jim, what are you looking at in terms of economic data indicators this year?
Yeah, so I mean, it's probably been the best part of a year since I came on the same podcast with you last year, Winnie. And I said then that I was watching pretty closely used car prices, you know, mainly via the Mannheim Index in the US. And I think that's, you know, still pretty important today. You know, the index was down about 20% since it peaked in late 2021. But I think the important thing is that the decline so far has been pretty orderly. The reason why I think it's important is that I think in many ways you can kind of use it as a bit of a proxy for new car pricing. So, you know, with a lot of noise out there in the media, especially at the moment about these, you know, deep, deep price cuts that we're seeing around EVs and the, you know, collapse in EV residual values, you know, I think it's important to kind of keep the broader picture in mind that, you know, EVs are still a pretty small part of the overall market overall. And so I would characterize, you know, the pricing market or the pricing environment as still holding up pretty well. And so ultimately, I think that actually bodes pretty well for the ability for the OEMs to maintain, you know, these margins and free cash flow. And it seems like consumers are still kind of stepping in to plug some of the gaps in terms of having demand, not only for used cars, but new cars as well.
Yeah, I mean, the EV headline noise has been really persistent, and it's hard to make sense of, you know, what is reality and what is the media all of a sudden really beating up on the EV space, which is an interesting turn of events. So Miriam, I want to shift to you and talk a little bit more about recent earning trends and also expectations from management teams and what those things are perhaps telling you about the outlook for the consumer. Is there broad-based kind of constructive sentiment, or would you say that kind of caution is still the game plan?
Yeah, so I think the main takeaway from management commentary this earnings season has been that they're still pretty cautious about the outlook for this year. So what we've seen so far is that certain products and categories have been harder hit than others. So a particularly weak category I would highlight is ice cream across Europe, where Unilever is heavily present. So Unilever's main ice cream brands are Magnum and Cornetto. And ice cream has actually been one of the categories where consumers have been happy to downtrade to cheaper private label options. And personally speaking, I would say that the private label ice cream options are actually pretty good. On the other hand, the Coca-Cola bottlers have actually remained fairly resilient despite being more of a premium offering. And I think that comes down to the uniqueness of the Coca-Cola brand, which isn't easily replicated by supermarket options. And I would certainly argue that supermarket cola doesn't taste as good as the real thing. So I think it really comes down to brand strength when it comes to whether consumers are willing to downtrade to private label options. I think what's interesting in the background to all this is that although we are seeing pockets of downtrading in certain food and bev items, when you look at the bigger picture when it comes to consumer health, actually, it has remained resilient and strong even when it comes to things like travel and leisure spending. It seems that consumers don't want to cut back on spending in these categories, even if they are feeling squeezed. And I think that reflects the fact that consumers are prioritizing what they spend their money on. So, for example, they might be happy to buy the Tesco version of Magnum to save a few pounds, which they can then put towards their holiday spending for the year. Another area where spending has remained incredibly resilient is in beauty and cosmetics. So, you know, consumers might be happy to go without certain food, but they don't want to go without fragrance and makeup. The beauty and cosmetics category actually has benefited from a post-COVID splurge, but it is also supported by long-term trends, including increasing focus on health and wellness. Moreover, beauty products are not bought as frequently as other consumer goods items, so consumers may not feel a need to cut back as much.
That is all so interesting. And also, Miriam, if you ever need help with this ice cream taste testing, especially across the pond in the US, I am happy to help out. I'm sure my kids would be as well. And you're right, like nothing hits like the real thing. I'm a Coke Zero girl all the way, and I don't want any of those store brands. So if consumers are being, you know, a little bit more specific in what they're willing to pay up for and what they're willing to trade down to, are there takeaways on different income brackets? I know a lot of people have been really concerned about those lower tier consumers who may have had more of a hit from elevated rent and energy costs or across different geographies.
I think what's interesting is that premium ranges across companies have actually held up pretty well. So beer, for example, premium products have generally been outpacing standard offerings. Of course, there's differences across geographies, but in the beer space in particular, what has been an enduring trend is that even if consumers are maybe drinking a little less, when they do drink, they want to make it count with a more premium offering. But generally, I would say it seems that higher income consumers are happy to carry on spending, which I don't think is that surprising. But what we have seen is that lower income consumers are feeling the squeeze and showing elevated signs of downtrading in the food space. So Nestle actually highlighted that in the US in the second half of last year, and Winnie, this might be something that you know more about than I do, but Nestle said that the end of emergency SNAP benefits had a larger impact than they had anticipated. So Nestle management actually admitted that they underestimated how much SNAP had been supporting spending in the food space, but when these payments were stopped, lower income consumers have actually reached for cheaper alternatives. That being said, downtrading, I would say, has definitely been more of a European theme, just because the private label offering is more developed in Europe than it is in the US. Then on the emerging market side, of course, have to start with China, where consumer confidence apparently remains very low. I think the China story has definitely been an important one for the sector. It absolutely is one of the key growth markets for the space. And I think a lot of people expected to see a snapback in spending, especially after the rapid recovery we saw in 2020 post the first lockdown. But I think COVID fatigue really kicked in, lots of understandable consumer caution. And of course, the economic environment there isn't the best either. So that's all culminated in pretty sluggish growth in the region. And that's also had an impact on other countries close to China. I think my expectation is that we're probably going to see a gradual recovery in China. I think the medium to long-term attractions of the market are very much intact, given the expansion of the middle classes. But it seems that we are in for a rough patch. And just quickly touching on the wider emerging market footprint, just sticking with Asia Pacific for a moment, it has been pretty mixed across the board, I would say. Markets like Japan and Korea have been pretty solid, but then Indonesia, for example, has been a bit of a weak spot due to the macro environment. And also given developments in the Middle East, certain consumers in markets like Indonesia have actually been boycotting global consumer brands. And Egypt has also seen similar. Other tough markets have been Vietnam, and in Africa, Nigeria has been a major weak spot. In Nigeria in particular, inflation has soared, the currency has seen extensive devaluation, and consumers there just don't currently have enough cash to spend. And finally, just to finish off with Latin America, I think what's interesting here is that we have seen very pronounced weakness in a category like spirits, where consumers have absolutely been downtrading cheaper alternatives, including beer. But other categories have been fairly resilient. So Nestlé, for example, has seen good growth for categories like confectionery, infant nutrition, coffee, dairy. So here it seems that consumers are prioritizing higher quality staples over something a bit more discretionary like spirits. So that was a very quick run through of some global dynamics. Of course, it can vary from product and vary by country as well. So mixed, but I think overall trends have been resilient enough at the global level that the multinational companies have generally been able to carry on reporting a resilient top line growth.
All right, resilient top line growth for the consumer despite these mixed trends on the consumer goods side of things. Jim, I'd be curious, do you have any takeaways on kind of consumer trends and preferences from recent auto sales?
Yeah, so I think, you know, following on from what Miriam was saying, I think the auto sector, there's a little bit of nuance that kind of needs to be brought into the conversation when we're talking about the consumer and autos, because not only is, you know, individuals buying vehicles, but there's also a huge role that's played by fleet operators as well. So the fleet operator aspect is something that, you know, I've been harping on about now for the best part of probably 2 years. But basically, since the, you know, the pandemic, you can kind of split the auto recovery into two pretty distinct periods. The first period, the kind of 2020, 2021, when we first came out of the pandemic, basically you had, you know, consumers that were flush with cash. They were keen for, you know, revenge spending. But given the supply chain issues, there was a shortage of vehicles. So we basically had OEMs that were very keen to prioritize selling to individuals, given that's a much higher business, a higher margin business, sorry. So, you know, during this period, fleet operators, you know, your rental car companies, corporate fleets, things like that, they were pretty much sidelined for a couple of years. And that kind of resulted in things like higher average fleet ages and also increased residual value risk. So that kind of transitioned over the 22-23 period, where we did start to see individual buyers start to take a bit of a step back from the market as interest rates rose and consumer confidence kind of slumped. But rather than, you know, a slump in vehicle sales overall, we basically saw fleet operators step back into the market and kind of absorb that increase in supply. And so what that really means is if you look back over the last sort of 4 years or so, we've, you know, in many respects gone through an entire cycle in terms of consumer demand on the auto side, but the headline numbers have actually remained pretty robust. So obviously the million-dollar question is what happens next. I would say ultimately, you know, we're still relatively optimistic on the outlook overall. I do think the dynamics that I alluded to in terms of, you know, excess demand from the fleet buying side, it's not something that can continue in perpetuity. But I do think it's going to remain a pillar of support over the next little while until potentially consumers step back into the market later on in the year.
So lots of moving pieces still on the autos side. Jim, I'm going to stick with you because the European auto sector has definitely participated in the flurry of new issue that we have seen to start the year. You know, markets across the globe are you know, tracking towards very robust annualized pace of issuance. I think that that is probably going to slow down over the course of the year. But I would just be curious if you have any takeaways around primary market activity. Have there been notable deals, comments on investor receptivity to some of these deals? You know, like Miriam said, they perceived access to capital for some of the hairier credits seems like it's improved pretty significantly. So any primary market commentary, Jim?
Yeah, so I think there's definitely been a lot of primary supply for autos, you know, in the first half of the year, but I do think that tends to be the case with autos because a lot of them often issue to fund their large captive operations. I do think what's interesting to note is that, you know, while demand has been pretty robust overall, you know, timing the primary market has been somewhat important. You know, for instance, at the very start of this year and then more recently, investor demand was super strong. But in between that, we did see periods where it was slightly softer, you know, where markets start to pull back a little bit. And I think that was reflected in, you know, books being a little bit not as well covered and maybe some higher new issue concessions. But I mean, to that point, I think what's been most surprising has been, you know, the lack of new issue concessions of late. We saw a couple of IG deals that have come to the market with, you know, no new issue premiums at all. You know, the book's obviously extremely well covered, you know, and I think Mariam mentioned that she even had a, you know, some bonds that priced inside the secondary. So I think going forward, we're probably going to see, you know, more proactive management of maturities, particularly on the high yield side. You know, for example, we saw Forvia issuing new debt last week. They launched a tender offer at the same time for 25 and 26 bonds, you know, so definitely trying to get ahead of some of the maturities in the next couple of years. And even, you know, we've seen some triple C names that have been pretty much shut out of the market for the best part of a couple of years now. There might be a bit of a window of opportunity if they have a compelling story. So we've seen that with the likes of Aston Martin, you know, a triple C rated name that's in the market looking to issue, you know, over £1 billion worth of bonds. TK Elevator as well, which has some triple C rated debt, you know, is doing a amend and extend transaction in its Term Loan Bs. So I think, you know, this might be an opportunity for some of those issuers that have maturities that are 25 or maybe even 26 for management team to try and get ahead of that. I think the other thing that may be of interest is that investors should be probably keeping quite a close eye on some of the call structures of some of the high coupon debt that was issued back in 2022 or 2023. You know, it's not going to take much of a move down in terms of, you know, rates. Obviously, the spread's already pretty tight to reprice those bonds to some of the first call dates or earlier call dates. You know, for instance, the Schaeffler PIK notes come to mind. You know, they only issued those late last year, but they're already trading. It was a 2028 bond that's already trading to a 2025 call. You know, and it's trading close to 108, 109, I think, on the cash price. So I think there's potentially some opportunities. Maybe not quite yet, but, you know, in the coming sort of 12 months or so for maybe management teams to look at some of that stuff as well.
Yeah, definitely thinking about those higher coupon bonds and what happens to them if central banks really do start cutting. So Miriam, you mentioned earlier that the perceived access to capital for some of your more stressed or storied issuers has improved materially. What's your view on the outlook for consumer primary activity in the near term?
We've had a quieter start to issuance in the year, at least compared to the auto sector. But now that earnings are done, I do expect a pickup on activity in the coming weeks. But of the few deals we have already had, pricing has been very favorable for the company, coming very close to secondary levels. And as you mentioned, I even had a couple of issuances where pricing actually came inside secondary levels. So I think on the whole, investors are pretty comfortable with the sector, despite ongoing concern about how consumers might fare this year. And I think that is supported by the fact that credit fundamentals remain sound and cash flows are also solid. So I think that should support primary issuance in the rest of this year.
All right. So more to come in the primary, especially on the consumer goods side of things. So one thing that we heard a bit about in Q3 earnings commentary and kind of over the course of Q4 is the deflationary environment and concerns from management teams that we might be hitting some deflation. Was that evident in any of the Q4 earnings, you know, the reality, or, you know, has there been still some focus on the potential for deflation? Miriam, let's start with you on the consumer goods side of things.
I would say that overall consensus from management teams is that we are not yet in a deflationary environment. Costs are still rising more slowly than before, obviously, and higher labor costs in particular have been a recurring theme. So as a result, pricing is still expected to increase this year, but volume will probably be a bigger contributor to top line growth. I think the consumer companies are particularly focused on promotional activity this year to drive volumes higher. And it's something we've heard again and again. Companies want to raise their marketing and growth investments this year to support their products and brands. So I think overall what we're looking at this year is slightly higher pricing, but generally not really negative, maybe save a few select categories where companies might want to focus on regaining competitiveness.
All right. So regaining competitiveness, I think that this is actually kind of a nice segue into the world of autos, especially on the EV side of things, where, Jim, as you noted, we've seen a lot of headlines and noise around EV pricing and demand. How are you thinking about pricing power this year and, you know, the risk of prices moving lower, which would be welcome for consumers, but not so great for OEMs?
Yeah. So I think in autos overall, I'd say the sector is still in a decent place. It's true, obviously, that inventories are starting to increase given the improvements in supply chain constraints. But overall, we're still at pretty healthy levels when we look in aggregate, you know, EVs and internal combustion engines. A bit of context, US dealer inventories troughed out at about 1 million units in late 2021 and have now rebounded to sit at about 2.4 million. So they have increased, but that's still pretty considerably below the kind of 3.5 to 4 million mark, which was pretty common in the pre-pandemic era. So overall, I'd say not so bad. But as you mentioned, in the EV space, it's a bit of a different story. We've seen a huge increase in competition, especially in China. But, you know, that's starting to spill over now into Europe and North America. I think it's important to note that, you know, the sector is having a bit of a moment here in terms of, you know, structural shifts in the context of EVs. And that's starting to really shake things up in terms of, you know, pricing from that perspective. So, you know, on the one hand, you've had a whole heap of new entrants in the market, you know, whether that be, you know, like a Tesla or a Polestar, but also the Chinese companies like BYD. And so, you know, these legacy OEMs are trying, you know, as hard as they can to kind of launch competitive lineups themselves. And I think in many respects, the auto sector is having, you know, kind of its Amazon or Uber moment, where a lot of these new startups are being given basically a blank checkbook and a license to do whatever it takes to win market share. And then with the hope that further down the line, they'll be able to, you know, consolidate that into a market leading position. Very tricky prospect for the legacy OEMs. You know, they're not really afforded with the same, I guess, entrepreneurial spirit, shall we call it, from shareholders. And so they're kind of stuck a little bit between a rock and a hard place where, you know, they're doing everything they can to keep prices elevated, while also being conscious that first mover advantage and having these market shares may prove to be, you know, gold dust when we look in 20 or 30 years on the horizon. But yeah, I mean, I think, again, to stress is that EVs are still only about 10-20% of group deliveries for most of the legacy big OEMs. And so, you know, I don't want to overplay the fact that, you know, it's all kind of doom and gloom out there for the European auto sector.
Great. Thank you so much, Jim. That is super helpful context for the OEMs and, you know, what EV pricing really means. I would love to be a beneficiary of these, you know, blank check entrepreneurial spirits. You know, perhaps we can put together some sort of ice cream taste testing effort that has, you know, solid financial backing. We'll see if we can get that going. Thank you so much, Miriam and Jim, for joining me today. This was a great conversation. If anyone has follow-up questions for any of the three of us, you can always find us on the creditsites.com website using that Ask an Analyst feature. Thank you so much and have a great day.
Credit Sites disclaimer. All price references correspond to the date of this recording. This podcast should not be copied, distributed, or reproduced in whole or in part. Neither Credit Sites nor its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of any information contained in this podcast. Credit Sites is not providing investment, legal, accounting, or tax advice, is not providing research or making any recommendations, nor is Credit Sites offering or soliciting any transaction with respect to the purchase or sale of any security. The receipt by this listener of this podcast is not the giving of advice by Credit Sites or its affiliates. Yes.